It was used to pay the farmer soldiers in George Washington's army. No one else lived in this country except farmers, or not many at least, and so all of his soldiers were, or practically all of them, were farmers. Well, as those farmer soldiers tried to spend the money, prices went up. Slowly at first, and then prices were multiplied by 5, 10, 20, 50, and 100 times and more. Well, several years later, Congress finally exchanged the new money for those continental bills. Congress paid off at a rate of 1 cent on the dollar. Congress paid 1 cent in good hard money for a dollar's worth of the continental currency that was paid to the soldiers. This currency became so worthless that it became a symbol of worthlessness. When folks wanted to illustrate the low value of some object, they would say that it is not worth a continental. Well, more than 150 years have passed since Washington's time, but we still use the expression, not worth a continental, although most of the folks who use it do not know where it came from. Well, now our second experience with great inflation occurred in the southern states at the time of the Civil War. Now, both sides in that conflict issued inconvertible paper currency. That issued at Washington lost about half of its original value, but this was later regained when the government took steps to pay it in gold, redeem it in gold. The currency issued by the government at Richmond, 100 miles south of Washington, eventually lost all of its value. And I think that perhaps this development caused more destruction in the South than all of General Grant's armies. Several other modern countries have suffered from gigantic inflations. Some of the first examples that come to mind are Germany, France, and China. The unhappy conditions of the people in these countries today is in part the result of their experiments and their experiences with inflation. Great inflations make it impossible to obtain credit for any purpose. No one wants to loan money or to hold money when its value is shrinking rapidly. Since many kinds of businesses cannot be carried on without credit, great inflation disrupts the production and the distribution of goods and services. Great inflations destroy the middle classes. All that is left are the very rich and the very poor. And that is a very unbalanced and unstable kind of society. Great inflations promote feverish speculation. Many people quit productive jobs to become speculators. This reduces rates of production of goods and services and therefore cuts standards of living. The incomes of many families fail to keep pace with the inflation of currency. This forces members of such families into illegal and even into immoral occupations. Lawlessness, crime, and personal degradation are the inevitable accompaniments of big inflations. Inflation is very closely related to politics. The history of the United States shows that we usually throw out any political party that is in power during a deflation. Thus, we threw out the Democrats in 1920, and thus we threw out the Republicans in 1932. Well, we now have had an almost continuous inflation for nearly 20 years. And that is probably the biggest reason we have kept the same political party for 20 years. Now, both major parties now know that inflation is a key to political success. Just try to figure out what that means to the nation's future economic policies. In the present world situation, our military and economic strength is very important. The control of inflation is essential to the development of our full potential powers. The President's Council of Economic Advisers emphasized this fact in its fifth annual report, which was very recently sent to the President. In this report, the Council said, "Our strength depends upon how well we combat inflation." I hope that it is clear that the control of inflation is essential to our future personal and national security. This brings up the last of our four questions. about inflation. This fourth question is, how can we prevent or control inflation? Methods for the control of inflation are easy to prescribe, but difficult to apply in a democracy, at least in an uneducated, relatively so, uneducated on the questions of money. It's very difficult to apply any rule that cannot receive public support, and if people do not understand why they should do this or something else, they will not support such policy. So it's difficult for us to adopt and carry out the programs we need for the control of inflation unless everyone, or at least a great majority of the people, understand what is being done, and I'm afraid that many people do not know what needs to be done. Now, economists explained the causes of inflation many years ago. As long as 300 years ago, they pointed out that the supply of money governs prices of commodities. That's the general price level. Much additional knowledge has been gained since that time. Inflation can be caused, it can be controlled, or it can be prevented by the adoption of policies and practices now known to economists and to many others as well. I think that economists are in essential agreement as to the causes of inflation. They are also in essential agreement as to the basic procedures for inflation control. Courses in money, credit, and banking are essentially the same at the University of Illinois, as at the University of Wisconsin, or Chicago, or Northwestern, or California, or Harvard, or in the London School of Economics. You can select 100 leading economists of this country, include economists from educational institutions, from government service, and from private business. Divide your group of 100 into 10 committees of 10 men each. Ask them to outline a program, each group to outline a program for the control of inflation in the current situation. Tell them what you expect in the way of a military program. Each group will make approximately the same general recommendations. Each group of economists will advise stopping inflation itself rather than merely trying to hide its symptoms. Each group would, I believe, agree upon some basic recommendations. Four of these would be as follows. First, we should stop the overly rapid increase in private borrowing from banks. Second, we should establish and maintain our national defense program and all other operations of the federal government upon a pay-as-we-go basis. Third, we should encourage and promote a rapid increase in industrial production under private ownership and control. And fourth, we should use direct controls over prices and wages and production very sparingly and only in unusual circumstances. And I would not want to include all of the year 1951 or every commodity or anything like that and cover that up and say, well, if the whole situation is unusual. That's not what I mean. Now, the inflation of 1950 came mostly from the excessive extension of bank credit. Inflation in 1951 threatens to come from the same source. Therefore, if we are to prevent inflation in the year ahead, we must do it by restrictions on credit. There are several ways of checking expansion in bank credit. One of these is controls over consumer credit. Some steps already have been taken along this line. For one thing, minimum down payments and maximum time limits have been established. For automobiles and some other items, the buyer must pay now at least one-third down and the remainder in not more than 15 months. Some people object that this makes it this is hard on the little fellow that doesn't have a third down payment. That's true. I don't know of any other way of carrying on a war without being hard on someone. Credit terms have been tightened up on housing, too. And people say, well, that denies the poor man an opportunity to have a new house. Well, it denies, I have no objection, if you want to, of prohibiting the building of big houses and thereby deny the big man a mansion. That probably make quite a little sense, and I suspect would be received with quite quite well by many people. But we have to hurt people if we're going to control inflation. Another way to check borrowing is to raise interest rates. Now, some steps in this direction have already been taken. Further increases should be made. We should note, however, that the U.S. Treasury Department is opposed to raising interest rates. It wants to keep interest rates low so that the national debt can be carried at relatively low cost. By contrast, the Federal Reserve Board, which supposedly controls monetary policy, wants to raise interest rates. In fact, it has already taken some steps to do so. However, a further increase in interest rates would be helpful in checking the increase in bank loans at this time. Now, one of the key programs for keeping interest rates low is the government's policy of supporting the price of government bonds. Sometimes we think that the price support for potatoes is the main one. It gets more play in the papers and perhaps others. But price support for government bonds has probably had more influence over our economic lives the last 5 years than a good many other support programs. Now, this price support program makes it very easy and profitable for banks to sell their government bonds to the Federal Reserve and to use the proceeds for making loans to individuals and to corporations. Now, one sound method of checking the expansion of bank credit would be for the government to drop its support of its own bonds. If it did this, bond prices might drop below par. If so, this would make it less profitable for banks to sell their bonds in order to make additional loans. This would tend to make interest rates higher and thus to restrict the expansion of bank credit. It would tend to check inflation. There are other methods of limiting bank loans to private individuals and corporations, but we do not have time to discuss them here. Now, contrary to popular opinion, the federal government has been operating within its income since we became involved in the Korean War last June. Furthermore, the prospect is, I believe, that the Treasury will have a balanced budget through most of 1951. Congress has made appropriations and authorized contracts in far greater amounts than it has yet provided tax income. However, payments on most of these contracts will not begin until till near the end of this year or later. We need to increase taxes in order to meet these larger expenses in 1952 and 1953. Now, both the President and the Congress have avowed that they want a pay-as-we-go defense program. Now, I am convinced that they will stick to such a program if they can find one that won't hurt anybody. Now, that may be unkind, that it is unkind to many of the people in our Congress. And yet, it's very, very difficult for people in Congress to pass taxes when the great pressures that are brought to them to tax somebody else, but don't tax us. Unfortunately, perhaps no one has as yet found painless taxpayers. Now, I find that some farmers and many of my own fellow workers believe that Congress will provide a pay-as-we-go program. I sincerely hope that they are right. Many people who urge higher taxes think that they can be secured by a soak-the-rich program. Now, this is politically very attractive, but it is mathematically impossible. A pay-as-we-go defense program means higher taxes for everybody. Everybody who has a good job, everybody who has a good business, everybody who has a good profession, everybody who is a successful farmer. A third important part of our inflation control program would be to increase the total output of goods and services. During the 5 years from 1939 to 1944, total output was increased by 3/4 in this country. That was done in spite of the fact that we took about 12 million of our most able workers away from productive jobs and put them in the armed services. Now, the President's Council of Economic Advisers believes that output can be increased by 1/4 in the next 5 years. Now, they recognize that we do not have as much unemployed labor and unused industrial capacity as we had in 1939, but they also point out that present plans call for only about one-fourth as many men in the armed forces as in 1944. My fourth recommendation is somewhat in the negative. It is that we use direct controls over prices, including prices for labor, very sparingly and only in unusual circumstances. I feel that for the past 5 years, the federal government has rather promoted and supported labor in many of its demands for higher wages. Such support should now be discontinued. Many farmers probably will agree with that view. Some will not agree with my next suggestion. It is that all price support programs for farm products be made inactive until after the threat of further inflation is passed. Two specific recommendations might be made. The first is that the export subsidy on wheat be discontinued. I think the wheat farmers are the most prosperous farmers in America today. They are surely a good deal more prosperous, those that operate on a large scale in the West, than many of us, at least, who are taxed to pay the subsidies.